Hello and welcome back to another episode of Humanities Matter by Brill. I'm your host, Ramzi Nasser. I am, among other things, an independent researcher based in Madrid, Spain, with a background in economics and West Asian studies. And today we have a fantastic episode for you. If the global order has experienced periods of stability and flux, then it's also recently seemed to many that we're entering a new period of systematic change. There's talk of a new multipolar world order with different poles of power beyond a single superpower, raising questions of how the countries of the world should organize shared domains. At the same time, space is decidedly becoming the next human frontier, and the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare a deep crisis in Western capitalism. What does all this mean for global systems, for countries, and for workers? Let's find out. Beginning in the skies, where questions about how to govern the space frontier really embody present challenges for governing the world. Professors P.J. Blunt and Mahulena Hoffman are volume editors of Brill's recent publication, Space Law in a Networked World. This book is the 19th volume in the series, Studies in Space Law, and it talks about how the traditional legal frameworks governing space technology are colliding with different legal structures. Professors Blunt and Hoffman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So the premise of your book is that laws for data privacy, cybersecurity, radio communication, software, and so on, these all have to apply to space technology. And at the same time that international space laws need to incorporate those other terrestrial laws into itself, and that all of that applies at the individual level, the corporate level, and the domestic level. Can you talk about how this evolution of laws is currently playing out and how you expect future comprehensive laws to develop?
Well, if I may, I think that the biggest problem lies in the fact that the international space law has been created in the 60s. And in the 70s, when the technology was completely different from the one of today. And it has a lot of impact on the today's perception of space activities, which are partly based on cyber. So at the beginning of the space law, we did not think about possibility of a cyber attack. We were speaking about a possibility of a physical attack of one satellite attacking another one. We were not thinking about the possibility for liability caused by a cyber attack. We were speaking about liability caused in the material sense. So you see that here is a great discrepancy between the international legal framework and the cybersecurity, which has not been overcome on the international level until now.
Yeah, to follow on that, I think that one of the things that we're trying to get with this volume is this idea that cyberspace or the internet is really cross-cutting across everything, right? I mean, it's been transformational over the past 20 years. And space isn't exempt from that sort of transformational moment that we get from sort of network technologies and digital technologies mashed together. I mean, we saw the first demonstration of internet via satellite was done in 1998, and how far it's come now has changed the context in which space activities unfold. And I think a good example of this is the way in which the industry itself has changed. So remote sensing companies, for instance, they used to collect data and they sold that data on, and the individual that would buy that data would then process that data and figure out what it means. But today, remote sensing companies are working to actually build their own data products, to process their own data and to mix that data with other data sources from the terrestrial sphere. And that brings in a world of data law and data policy into the space domain. And this cuts across almost all space activities, and in particular, the one that Mahalena mentioned, this idea of cybersecurity.
Fantastic. And how do you think that will affect future comprehensive legal development?
I think it's very difficult to judge. On the international level, we have only one international treaty which deals with cyber protection, and it's a treaty adopted under the auspices of the Council of Europe. I think that this issue will be hardly covered by international space law. I think that the focus will lay in on the level of regional law, as in Europe, the European law, and in the national legislation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the takeaways in this book is that the law itself just doesn't reach as far as all of the changes that are happening. And so one of the phenomenons that we're seeing is that we see, you know, sub-statutory or sub-regulatory documents that become to be that slowly become legalized in a sense, right? So we see standards come out, and these standards describe, for instance, how a company will engage in cybersecurity compliance. Well, those standards then get implicated into contracts and become legalized in that way. And we're seeing this sort of up and down the legal chain. So, you know, one of the places where you'll see it, and I think two chapters actually talk about this, is how cybersecurity standards adopted by the U.S. government actually play down in the procurement process and impose legal obligations on their contractors. Now, those legal obligations, those standards, aren't legally binding in the sense of law, but they end up binding the operator nonetheless. And so this is one of the things that I think we're seeing come out in this sort of new technological world, is that we see what might be called technical regulation or technical standards coming in and filling gaps that the law hasn't filled itself.
Great. And just shifting the conversation a little bit, if competition between countries and private corporations like SpaceX or Amazon to put technology up in space is any indication, it could be argued perhaps that space is becoming the next arena for international power politics. Do you think that in addition to data and technology-related laws, that laws related to international cooperation will also need to change?
I think that outer space was always an arena of cooperation and competition. At the same time, it started already in the 50s with the first satellites. I don't think that much has changed in the perception of this aspect. And I don't think that a new way of thinking about international law as a tool for enhancing cooperation is necessary. We see some initiatives which are slightly different than the classical framework of space law, like the Artemis Accords. But we had also many years ago the International Space Station, which was also based on a multilateral framework than on the UN space law basis. So I don't see here any new paradigm which would need to change the whole system of international space law, but perhaps Dr. Blount has another opinion.
I agree. I mean, I think that when it comes to international obligation, right, international cooperation, there is a legal obligation to do so, but it's a very weak obligation. It's you get to choose how you're going to cooperate, and you get to choose who you're going to cooperate with. So at the end of the day, cooperation is very much built around sort of a political desire to cooperate with another entity. And that desire could be just based on the idea that you're allies and you want to, or it could be based on sort of, you know, US-Soviet cooperation, this idea that we might be able to reduce security tensions. And so that's always been a part of space law. I think that one of the issues that this question gets to is the idea that the geopolitics have changed. And as the geopolitics change, that creates fault lines amongst the different states that might want to cooperate with each other. And so one of the core challenges, I think, going forward in space law isn't necessarily reforming the law, But it's about thinking about the normative structures that actually support the law and make the law work. And one of the things that we have to accept about international space law is it's very much built on this idea of transparency and cooperation. Even though those are somewhat weak obligations, it's built around that framework. And so I think that that reestablishing normative frameworks that promote cooperation and promote transparency is critical. And I think that we see this happening. There's this debate, this discourse happening right now in the realm of space security law surrounding, you know, things like the prevention of an arms race on in outer space, and how that's playing out at the Conference on Disarmament, as well as in the first and fourth committees of the United Nations.
Yeah, that's exactly where I wanted to go next. I was struck by the question of Star Wars when reading the volume. Although none of the chapters take it up directly, the possibility of cybersecurity attacks that might be linked to wars, or even attacks on physical space infrastructure. With the increasing integration of space assets into critical terrestrial infrastructure and the infrastructure of war, do you think the laws of war themselves might need to integrate into space law and vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a need to think about the law of armed conflict as it applies in different domains. And space and cyberspace are sort of the two domains that are currently presenting the most challenges in this. The physics are different. The way they operate is different, which means that a lot of the laws that were written for land and naval and air combat don't translate as clearly or as well. That said, you know, the law of armed conflict is something that has traditionally been sort of built on narratives and built on custom and built on sort of a discourse amongst states. And so I think that probably at the beginning, we're going to see states talking and figuring out what the norms should be well before we see any reform in the form of a treaty or some sort of other move forward. We have though seen the sort of the initial stages of this work happen. So there's the Talon Manual for Cyberspace, as well as the Woomera Manual, which I don't think has been published yet, but it's being developed for the space context. And these two manuals begin to help us to think about what the customary law of war, how it would apply in these areas. But I think that there is a big problem. I think that when we get to space, right, there might be opportunity for states to agree on what the laws of armed conflict are there. But when we bring in cyberspace, I think cyberspace incentivizes states to stand in opposition to the development of legal norms because of the way that a network domain works. It's difficult to do things like disarmament and deterrence, and it's very favorable for states to be able to interfere in another state via cyberspace without necessarily breaching Article 2.4 of the UN Charter.
I absolutely agree. And we can also add that some aspects of the Star Wars perhaps go beyond the present international space law. Under the current legal framework, the celestial bodies are completely demilitarized. So it is not possible to lead any war on celestial bodies, to put it bluntly. And the orbits around the Earth, they are partly demilitarized. It is not possible to place there any weapons of mass destruction. So we have already some important provisions which substantially narrow down the possibility of a military conflict. And of course, there is the rule that no aggressive war is possible in outer space. So no military attack is possible because the UN Charter, as Dr. Blunt rightly said, is completely valid in outer space. And to answer your question whether the law of war should be applied in outer space, I think, yes, it should. It's a customary international law, and its principle, for instance, of differentiation between combatants and non-combatants, between civil population and the military, should be taken into account also in outer space. But as I said, we had a complete prohibition of using celestial bodies for military operations.
Well, that's very comforting. Moving back down to Earth, I guess, is the fact that space technology is becoming more irrevocably ingrained in the running of our world, going to force alterations in legal frameworks, such as the integration of space laws and the laws that protect individual data privacy or open data policies that provide more information to the people? And could that perhaps tip the socio-political balance in favor of the people versus corporations and the state?
So, I mean, I think this sort of goes all the way back to Mahalena's first comment, right? The idea that when we think of space law, we are thinking of law that was written for another type of technology. Now, that said, I mean, space law was written very broadly in broad principles that can be applied across lots of different technologies. But at the end of the day, space law was very much attempting to sort of think about this in terms of humanity, right? The opening phrase from the Outer Space Treaty of, you know, the use and exploration of space is the province of all mankind, right? It's this idea that humanity should have an active role in this process of space exploration. But as we have moved into a more commercial time, there have been a lot of questions, right? Are we still using all of this for the benefit of all? And I think that this is sort of the struggle when it comes to technology in general, right? Innovation is something that should benefit society, but it's also something that's premised on commercial gain and commercial profit. And how we structure the law and how we structure or use the law to structure technologies and to build frameworks around technologies, I think is incredibly important for striking that balance between innovation that creates profit and therefore creates more innovation, but also innovation that supports society and helps humanity. And I think that we see this play out in both sort of the digital world, the cyberspace, but also in the space world itself. And so, yeah, I mean, the law has to continue to adapt. But I think that the challenge that we have to face going forward is thinking about how we use the law to benefit all, but at the same time, to not, you know, lose this idea of being able to innovate and be able to create new things that can help everybody.
I absolutely share this position and would like to complement it by saying that we have also to be realistic. We saw at the time when states in the UN tried to prohibit the remote sensing of the Earth from outer space, it turned to be unrealistic to try to protect the states from being observed from outer space. And we are facing a similar situation today. So as you rightly said in your question, the satellites are collecting plethora of information from the Earth. And it is very important to have the laws which protect the bearer of the personal data. But on the other hand, not all data can be protected. And for instance, in the European legal framework, we see this criteria of identifiability as the main tool for, on the other hand, protecting the individual personal data, but on the other hand, allowing the use of space or satellite data for agriculture, for protection of the environment, and so on. So it's a very sensitive issue. Also, this criteria of identifiability is also a flexible one. But I think that it is possible to draw a line between the necessity to protect our personal data and the need to proceed with space activities.
Is there anything else you wanted to add that you think is important to highlight about this volume, or about where you think we are headed or should try to head?
So if I may, the book is worth reading, not because it explains the development of the international space law in view of cyber activities, but it also entails a lot of very important details of how this protection or how this relation is treated in the practice. So it is not only a research book, but it also compiles the analysis of colleagues who are working on the spot in this area. And I think it makes it extremely valuable for not only researchers, but also for practitioners.
I'll add that I think that one of the things that we do in this book that's important is, and this kind of actually reflects this conversation, we often, when we're talking about cyber and when we're talking about space, we tend to focus in on risks, right? What are the risks? What are the security challenges that are there? And those are there, right? There are a lot of risks and there are a lot of security challenges. And the first part of this book really does dive into cybersecurity. But I think we also try to bring in this idea that there are opportunities, and these technologies give us opportunities to do really amazing and incredible things. And the lawyer doesn't just have a role when it comes to risks. The lawyer has a role when it comes to opportunities as well, and finding ways to get their client into a place where they can do great things with their technology. And so one of the things that I think that we do in this book is actually have a conversation about opportunities as well and ways in which we can use this technology in order to serve humanity.
Thank you, Professors Blunt and Professor Hoffman, for sitting down with us today. From questions about how different countries should share the skies, to questions of how citizens should share the state. Our next guest, Dr. Noel Chellen, argues that the recent COVID pandemic really underscored a profound crisis in democratic capitalism today. Dr. Chellen is the author of Failing Ailing Capitalism and the Challenge of COVID-19, published by Brill. It's part of a much larger, longer-standing series on studies in critical social sciences, and it is followed by a second book, Capitalism and COVID-19, Time to Make a Democratic New World Order. Dr. Chellen, your two books are very ambitious and far-reaching. The first has a bit more of a diagnostic orientation, and the second book seems a bit more prescriptive. Today, I'd like to focus on the first of these two, and perhaps we'll have you on the show in the future again to continue the conversation about the second book. My first question, just to kick us off, you argue in this first book that during the COVID pandemic, citizens in the democratic capitalist West died needlessly. What is what you call an inconvenient truth in the age of comparative statistics and measurement?
Hello, Ramsey. Thank you for the opportunity to share my work on capitalism and COVID-19. COVID-19 has generated huge amounts of data about the real world that we live in. It has debunked the ideology of the West as a cradle of the good life, and dare it be said, as the bastion of civilization. The evidence is in the number of citizens infected and died in capitalist and democratic countries. The sources for such information is the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. The countries with the highest death rates in the world from COVID-19 are Western and capitalist in orientation. The Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center stopped collecting COVID-19 data as of 10th March 2023. The following are death figures in some Western countries, with the United States leading the entire world in terms of the number of its citizens that died from COVID-19. The United States at 1,123,836, capitalist India at 530,779, the United Kingdom at 220,721, Italy with 188,322 of its citizens that died from COVID-19, and France at 166,176. On the other hand, socialist or communist countries like China, Vietnam, and Cuba have managed to keep their citizens relatively safe from COVID-19 when compared to Western and capitalist countries. The total number of deaths for China stands at 101,056, for socialist Vietnam at 43,186, and socialist Cuba with 8,530 deaths. From evidence gathered, it is taken as given that all countries, including the democratic West, underreported their COVID-19 infections and death figures. India is thought to have grossly underreported its figures. We live in an age of comparisons and statistics. For example, we compare GDPs across nations, we compare population numbers, we compare which vaccines are the best, we compare democratic to autocratic countries, etc. So how did the richest and most powerful country in the world, namely the United States, enable more than 1.1 million of its citizens to die, whilst in China, the total number of deaths stands at just over 100,000? Why was the death rate 11 times more in capitalist and democratic United States than in socialist China? So however Western powers wish to demonize and defame China, the Johns Hopkins University and Medicine Coronavirus Resource Center will forever demonstrate that China outsmarted COVID-19, but COVID-19 outsmarted the Western world. However Western powers attempt to name and shame China on its human rights abuses, they must at the same time pronounce on China's admirable ability to secure the right to life of the Chinese people, whilst Western powers fail to secure or abandon the right to life of its citizens. China's success in dealing with COVID-19 has become a blind spot in the global narrative on COVID-19. Western and capitalist countries made certain to keep this inconvenient truth buried deep within the heaviness of Western ideologies parading as democratic and Western values. In an age of statistics, measurement, and comparisons, this is the inconvenient truth that the Western world will have to live with in the years and decades ahead. It is an inconvenient truth because the West would like the rest of the world to not make that comparison between capitalist United States and socialist China. After all, we keep hearing how good capitalism is and how bad socialism is.
You blame capitalism for these needless deaths. What is it about capitalism specifically that you blame?
So as to try and answer the question as to how capitalism is specifically to blame, we have to first get to the heart and soul of capitalism, so to speak. Far from the appearances of free markets, supply and demand economics, etc., capitalism's innate and fundamental value, logic or ideology, is that of profit and profit maximization, and not saving lives. In fact, this ideology takes place at the expense of lives. We see this fact play out in the United States often in the mass killings of children, women, and men. Profit from gun sales takes precedence over life itself. Profit is the overarching ideology of capitalism. Never has there been a time in history when a creature from nature threw up so much data and information about the real world we live in. COVID-19 also provided huge amounts of data to support Karl Marx's analysis of capitalism, that under the capitalist system, the economy and money are ends in and of themselves. This conflict of money and the economy as ends or means were played out during a global pandemic in the Western world in the main. There is so much of money, so much of technology, and so much of science in the Western world, but all of these centuries of human progresses fail to save that which is most important, life itself. The innate value and ideology of capitalism in the West was glaringly clear when it came to the issue of the intellectual property on vaccines. Here too, the Western world chose profit over saving lives. When information to save lives was not made available to the rest of the world. The question is, how did such pharmaceutical companies access this intellectual property? Were they the sole creators and innovators of such intellectual property, or was such intellectual property derived from volunteers in global society who were infected with COVID-19? It therefore leaves us with the following question: is such intellectual property private or public? Another fundamental ideology of capitalism is that the state should not take center stage in the economy. However, this ideology was also allowed to be dominant in capitalist countries in the time of a global pandemic. The survival of the fittest is also an important ideology of capitalism. This ideology manifested itself as herd immunity and was practiced at the onset of COVID-19 in the United Kingdom. This capitalist ideology in the time of a global pandemic is said to have caused the loss of many lives in the UK.
And moving on from capitalism's responsibility, you talk about how there is an imperfect understanding and an imperfect paradigm of liberty, freedom, democracy, and human rights in the Western world. That there's something imperfect about the way that in the West we conceive of these things. What do you mean by that?
An argument can be made that during COVID-19, countries with a collectivist culture perform much better than countries with an individualistic culture. The Western world's understanding of human rights is narrowed down to that of merely individual rights. We have to ask the following question. What is the individual's responsibility to his family, his friends, his community, etc., especially during a global pandemic? Humans are social animals. We are part of the human race. We are part of society. But this fact and reality is heavily smothered by the Western ideology of the individual as supreme and above that of the collective. This individualistic ideology was made famous and got huge traction when a once former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher, stated that there is no such thing as society. Under the Western model of democracy, most value is allocated to free speech, gun ownership, the right to not wear a mask, the right to practice in religious gatherings, the right to privacy in the time of a global pandemic, etc. But little value is placed on life itself, as was proven during COVID-19. The little value on life is continually demonstrated when US citizens are killed at one go because Americans are sold the idea that gun ownership is their human right. The right to life is hardly part of the Western narrative when such mass shootings and killings takes place, and also when the rest of the world is lectured to about democracy and Western values. COVID-19 was a practical challenge that required a practical response, but in most parts of the Western world, the response was mostly ideological. I believe, for example, that more people could have been saved in the West if the tracking and tracing app was widely used, as was the case in South Korea, for example. Instead, the right to privacy took precedence over that of the right to life itself. Liberty, freedom, democracy, privacy, and human rights are fundamental values for humankind. But before humankind can possess such important rights, it must first be given a chance to stay alive. This was simply not the case in the Western world. We also cannot ignore the hypocrisy and double standards of the Western world on the very important subjects of liberty, freedom, democracy, and human rights. For example, the United Kingdom and the United States did not support the freedom, liberty, and human rights of South Africa's black majority during the dark days of apartheid. In fact, these two very powerful nations benefited immensely from the denial and deprivation of freedom, liberty, and human rights of black South Africans. We also do not see the Western world calling for the freedom, liberty, and human rights of the Palestinian people. We in South Africa were once separated on the basis of race, but in 1994, we subjected ourselves to the democratic process. Maybe the Palestinians and Israelis should also be advised by the West to subject themselves to the democratic process instead of encouraging separation on the basis of religion. The Western world claims that freedom, democracy, and human rights are what the West cares about most. But the world is gradually learning that economic and geopolitical interests are first and foremost what is dearest to their hearts and minds. For the West, liberty, freedom, democracy, and human rights are, to use a colleague's word, weapons of mass destruction.
You also seem to argue that even though for a very long time people have spoken about a democratic capitalist West, a hyphenated democratic capitalism that we have in Western countries, that in fact capitalism both subordinates and limits democracy. Is that an accurate characterization of your argument?
The West has always prided itself on being the defenders of democracy, freedom, liberty, and free speech. Such cherishing of these values was evident when more than 40 world leaders gathered in Paris in 2015 to join the massive rally in defense of the right to the freedom of expression. However, after Trump's free speech at a rally on 6 January 2021, Twitter censored Trump indefinitely from freely expressing himself. The 40 leaders who flew to Paris in 2015 to uphold free speech did not make their way to the United States to do the same. The censorship of a US president by Twitter laid bare the myth and illusion of free speech in the capitalist West. A president of the United States had free speech taken away by the free market. We learned firsthand that capitalist ideologies and the free market are the dominant and final arbiters of the current model of democracy in the capitalist world. There has also been much written and spoken on the weaknesses of the quality of America's democracy, since big money often determines the outcome of democratic elections. It is also an open secret that the US's foreign policy is to destabilize countries that do not embrace the capitalist way of life. Most times, the justification given for the invasion of countries is that of exporting democracy to other parts of the world. Usually, the end game of the mass invasion is to trigger and force a change in governance so as to secure the dominance of capitalist interests and US hegemony. The United States is said to be the oldest democracy, yet the United States experienced the highest COVID-19 death rate in the world. This is evidence of the contradiction of the current model of democracy, one which is subservient and subordinate to the ideologies of capitalism. In capitalist society, political freedom does not necessarily entail economic freedom. We see material evidence of this in countries like South Africa, the last country on the African continent to achieve political freedom and to put in place a Western-styled democracy. Yet, 29 years after attaining democracy, the majority of South Africa's population are still in economic bondage. Millions of black South Africans have still not benefited materially from the 1994 democratic breakthrough. Blacks in South Africa now have rights, but many still go to bed hungry at night. They have liberty, but many still live in makeshift tin homes. South Africans have freedom, but are still killed, raped, and robbed in the dozens like in no other country in the world. South Africa is a democracy, but its democracy is submissive to the ideologies of capitalism, the main ideology being that of private property in relation to the means of production. For example, about 10% of South Africans own 80% of South Africa's fertile land. 29 years of Western-style democracy has not addressed this capitalist contradiction. It is therefore hardly surprising that the May 29 cover of Time magazine revealed South Africa to be the most unequal country in the world. Democratic South Africa is the most developed economy on the African continent, yet South Africa experienced the highest COVID-19 death rate on the continent. Where capitalism and democracy exist, capitalist ideologies almost always outshines democratic values and principles.
My last question I'd like to ask you is, If it is correct that the capitalist West is indeed having a crisis of democracy, are there any alternative models of governance that it can look to as possible different future or with a different mode of organization that it can adopt?
If anything, the crisis that is engulfing the world at the moment is a signifier of a deficient democratic model. The issue is not democracy per se, but rather the quantitative as well as qualitative forms of democracy operating currently in much of the world. In other words, there is not enough democracy in capitalist society, and it is of a very poor quality. For example, there is no or too little forms of participatory democracy. The dominant model of democracy places emphasis on democratizing governance in the political sphere, but not on capitalist society's economic sphere, such as the governance of monies, energy, workplaces, etc. We must ask why democracy seems paramount for the political sphere, but not for the economic sphere, for society's effective and efficient functioning. Would the great crises of 2008 have happened if the financial and banking sectors were under democratic governance? It was the democratic political sphere under then-President Barack Obama that bailed out the non-democratic economic, financial, and banking sectors. Will climate change be meaningfully addressed if the energy sector is brought under democratic governance, as opposed to the current form of governance, what may be termed as the governance of shareholders? Will the threat and fear of job losses be addressed if artificial intelligence is brought under democratic governance? Will lives be unnecessarily lost again if big pharmaceutical companies are under democratic governance by the time the next pandemic comes along? Will children in the United States be certain of experiencing the joys of childhood if the NRA in the United States is brought under democratic governance? Will countries like South Africa still be featured on Time magazine as being the most unequal if South Africa's land and economy is democratically governed to ensure that the needs of all instead of the greed of a few are met? I think that the Labour Party's slogan in the UK is for the many, not for the few. Will women in the US have more say over their bodies if a democratic referendum was awarded to women only to decide on the use of their bodies instead of the current form of representative governance deciding the fate of women's bodies? The world in general and the West in particular should ensure a move towards democratic governance, not only of the political sphere, but of the economic sphere as well. The current democratic model is one that is heavily biased in favor of representative democracy. However, we are learning that when politicians are democratically elected, they do not necessarily represent the interests of their citizens, but that of special interests underpinned by capitalist values and ideologies. Global society has to also explore ways to ensure more participatory forms of democratic functioning. The amazingly high level of technological development in the 21st century makes the governance of society's planning and functioning through participatory democracy possible and viable. Another very vital sphere where the West in general and the US in particular does not practice and respect the principles and values of democracy is at the international level, namely at the United Nations. For example, in 2012, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to recognize Palestine as a state in the face of opposition from Israel and the United States. The 193 member assembly voted 138 in favor of the plan. In 2023, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a resolution to demand the end of the US economic blockade on Cuba for the 29th year in a row, with the United States and Israel again voting against it. Is it not time for these two countries that stake a claim to Western values and democracy, respect a democratic vote of the United Nations for improved governance of a very complex world and a planet under huge strain? We should therefore demand democratic functioning within the economic sphere, more participatory democracy at different levels within countries, and democratic practices and accountability at the international level, namely at the United Nations level.
That was Dr. Challen, author of Failing Ailing Capitalism and the Challenge of COVID-19, published by Brio. Finally, if capitalism is putting pressure on Western democracies, in the global South, it's also putting particular pressure on workers. Our last guest today is Dr. Anita Hammer. She is co-editor, along with Dr. Emmanuel Ness, of Global Rupture, Neoliberal Capitalism and the Rise of Informal Labor in the Global South, published by Brill. Dr. Hammer is at King's College London. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hammer. Your edited volume is organized into geographical categories. What informed that approach to the book, and what conclusions do you draw more broadly about trends that replicate across all these different case studies?
We went for the geographical categories, Ramzi, in order to convey the vastness and the relevance of the Global South to academia as well as to activists, because it comprises swathes of three continents and indeed beyond that. And that is where the global majority lives and where the majority of the workforce labors. So we thought that is very important. At the same time, analytically, the key argument of our book is that we need to look at informal and precarious work as embedded in concrete historical, political, and social context, influenced by centuries of colonial rule, through structural adjustments, through neo-imperialism, in very context-specific ways. So what I would say is geography is important. It is a powerful way of visualizing and analyzing relations of power between the global north and the south, between different countries, and indeed within countries, if we are looking at large countries, say, for example, India. And finally, what I would say is geography is important, and hence our categories, because resistance of workers, which is a key underlying theme of our book, after all, the resources that labor has, the terrains of struggle, the expressions are very spatially and, of course, temporally specific. And I guess that is why we decided to go with a geographical categorization of our case studies. At the same time, as you rightly ask, there are very clear overarching trends across these cases. And the first and the most fundamental one is that informal employment and informalization is increasing across the world, and particularly the global south. Now, this is despite the multiple development interventions that international organizations in the global north, like the World Bank, the International Monetary Funds, and in a more progressive way, the International Labour Organization, they have imposed to an extent on the south, but also southern governments have embraced them. And the hope was that it was an industrial catch-up that was required in the south by southern economies, and all informal work will become formal work over time. Well, as this book has shown, that hasn't happened, and that hasn't happened across any of the continents that this book represents. The second trend, which you can notice across the case studies, is that it is the conflict between capital and labor, which is central to understanding the differentiation of workforce, which informality and informalization represents. So on the one hand, you have capital or firms which are actively reshaping the composition of the workforce to restrict the bargaining power of labor. It's fragmenting them from a formal workforce to different types of informal employment relations. For example, contract work, casual work, put-out work, etc. And the state is, to an extent, complicit in this, directly or indirectly, openly or otherwise, because it enables and it institutionalizes informalization, either through defining the scope of regulation or through shaping the power relations between capital and labor. So what I would say is geography is important, it's very relevant, it's very powerful. And at the same time, what the book shows is there are very clear overarching trends.
That's fantastically clear, makes clear the importance of your work to combat that orthodox story. Looking specifically at Cambodia, where there's a fantastic chapter on garment workers, the contributor there was describing what she saw as a hidden process of informalization. So this increasing form of informalization, which you were describing for her in Cambodia, that process of increasing informal work is somehow hidden. Can you share with our listeners, as you understand it, what characterizes informalization as a process more broadly, and to what degree in general that it depends or relies on obscuring visibility of that process?
Yes, that's a very interesting and relevant question. So informalization is a process through which formal or organized labor, workers who have had a standard employment relationship, who have fair, decent, or living wages, have a certain level of employment security, are protected through social security, for example, access to sickness pay, pensions, leave, health and safety standards ensured. All these aspects, which are characteristics of a formal employment, what processes of informalization are doing is they are taking that away so that workers are insecure and face constant instability. So they are on low wages, and in case of the Global South, often on survivalist wages. They have insecurity of employment. They have limited or in some cases no social protection. So what you have is, from permanent employment positions, you have workers who are being informalized to a range of informal employment relations, such as casual workers, contract workers, those outsourced and subcontracted, and all the associated forms of labor that exists, unpaid family labor, or labor that is controlled through relations of debt, etc. So that's what informalization denotes. It's an ongoing process. It's a process that has become stronger under neoliberal capitalism. And it's growing. When you talk about the Cambodian case of women garment workers, that's a very interesting case study. And in a way, it is a good example of what I said about there are different forms of informal employment, casual contract, family labor, etc. Similarly, there are different levels and processes of informalization. So the women garment workers in the garment value chains, which touch down in Cambodia, are in a way formal. They are in the formal sector, that is, they have a formally recognized employment relationships. So technically speaking, they fall in the realm of formal workers. But in reality, they are something which is known as, in fact, informalized workers through subcontracting and short-term contracts. So I'll give an example of why it is hidden process of informalization, because all the international labor standards are adhered to in Cambodia by the international multinational firms, and they are enshrined in the national legal frameworks also. So for example, the short-term workers on short-term contracts are allowed to form unions just like permanent workers are. But in reality, the way women workers in subcontracted firms and on short-term contracts work, they are discouraged to become part of union, to join unions. And the reason for that is that they are severely constrained by their gendered and intergenerational needs. So for example, women would like to work near home so that they can combine paid and care work. Or some younger workers would like to have more flexibility, which the short-term contracts provide, so that they can go and help in their rural families during harvesting seasons. So what the case is trying to show is, even though in a way they fall under the realm of formal, through these mechanisms, capital and state are, in fact, informalizing them, constraining them, and weakening them. Another example in Cambodia is that workers prefer short-term contracts and the insecurity that comes with it, partly because of their gendered and intergenerational needs, care work, etc., but also because they get 5% severance pay once their contract comes to an end. And that gives them access to a certain amount of money, which they don't have in other circumstances. And they prefer to have that rather than accumulate seniority at work or to have some sort of a provident fund or some form of pension, because they don't trust employers or the state. They prefer that 5% in hand at the end of a contract to promise or hope of some money in the future. And lastly, another example of the hidden nature of informalization is that employers in Cambodia are actually paying some garment workers to shift from permanent to short-term contracts. And again, for the same reason that I just mentioned, workers sometimes prefer, because it gives them access to that money that they need in their insecure, uncertain, precarious lives, to rather than the security of a permanent contract.
There was another chapter on Argentina about delivery platform workers and their experience during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it talks about digital resistance among them. And the question is, beyond the negative aspects of increasing digitization, with especially increasing surveillance, in this context, I think you would say surveillance on behalf of capital, is there potential for technology to act as a liberatory medium or an empowering medium for workers, for labor in the global south?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that chapter is striking, and it is so full of hope and concrete results, isn't it? I mean, it shows that shows the creativity and adaptability of the delivery platform workers in Argentina to organize themselves and to protest in highly constrained circumstances. Now, COVID-19 pandemic, which is where this case study is from, temporarily, is when these platform workers were severely constrained. They had precarious job contracts and everything, all the insecurity that accompanied that. There was a total absence of state regulation of the employment relations between workers and platforms. Platforms were extremely powerful, and they used that to control these delivery workers. For example, they weren't provided any protection, PPEs, etc. There was no hygiene protocol. They were not allowed to take any leave if they were unwell or if one of their family members were unwell. So often the choice that these delivery platform workers had was between health of their own or their family members versus earning and earnings for survival. Now, in those kind of challenging circumstances, the workers of Argentina show how they could organize themselves and build on their common grievances and experiences using digital technology. I mean, now, as you know, workers build solidarity at the workplace in the labor process, while which they participate in jointly. Now, the technology has taken that away, but the same workers use those same technologies to organize digitally. They organized digital assemblies. They organized strikes to those using that digital technology. And they could do that across platforms and indeed across borders. So this was not specific to Argentina, but there was solidarity that was formed across borders with Brazilian delivery platform workers. So in that way, they could organize themselves, build on their grievances and experiences, and actually take collective action. And I think that shows that how technology can be used to liberate, to mobilize, to organize, and to take collective action. And that is something that Marx wrote about earlier. The employers use technology to control and to extract maximum surplus from labor, but labor has historically, and as this case shows, can use technology to its own purpose also.
There's obviously a focus in this volume on the Global South. In your introduction, you also mention, and I quote here, informal labor remains an enduring reality across the Global South and is growing fast in the North, end quote. When and how do you see informal labor becoming more prevalent in the Global North?
I mean, what I would say is that informal labor is probably not as strikingly visible in the Global North. But in a way, it has always existed. It is just that it is beginning to get more visible, but on the margins of the formal economy in the Global North. So how I would say is what's happening in the North is there is a shift away from the standard employment relationship. That is the employment relationship which was more secure and came with labor market protections and some welfare provisions for workers in the North. And increasingly, there is a move to shift social and economic risks from capital to workers. And that is the rise of precarity and precarious workers on low pay and increasing insecurity. So one trend is noticeable there. Now, that is shifting the balance of power between capital and labor in the North. Now, there has always been an asymmetric balance between capital and labor. But the struggles of the 20th century, at least in the North, strengthened organized labor. And through that, through the welfare state, through the tripartism that we see in the North, labor was a partner at the table and could ensure certain basic measures of employment security and protection. That is shifting now under neoliberalism. And one of the ways it's quite visible now is the best example is that of the gig economy. So if you look at care workers in the North, care workers who were so prominent during the pandemic, as you know, now they are only paid for the actual time that their care visit takes. So the time that they have in commuting or when moving on to their next appointment, that is not paid. So how are they supposed to support themselves? Look at warehouse workers. They are not paid for the time it takes them to commute to workplace, to check in, to change into their uniform, till they are at their workstation. Another striking one, form of employment that you can see, which is more on the informal side of the spectrum, is the bogus self-employment that we saw in case of Uber. That's very similar to dependent self-employment that you see in the global south also. So they are in technically termed as self-employed so that platforms or employers don't owe them anything, basic employment rights and social security. Rather, they are self-employed. But as platforms show us, as the case of Uber shows us, these workers are actually totally dependent on these platforms and are controlled by those platforms. And in this way, informal work is becoming prominent. The precarious nature of work is gaining prominence in the North.
Against that pessimistic background, how do you see the prospects for advancement towards a decent work agenda worldwide, and specifically to reversing the expansion of informal and precarious work in the global South?
Firstly, Ramzi, I wouldn't say that it is pessimistic at all. I think all the case studies in the book actually show that how workers are actually mobilizing, sometimes individually, okay, sometimes collectively, despite these developments, despite capital and state trying to institute informality and insecurity. I mean, there is workers' resistance, sometimes strong, sometimes not as strong, sometimes open, sometimes indirect, sometimes individual, as we can see in case of Cambodia or the Middle East, and sometimes through very organized collective action, as the case of auto workers in India shows, and delivery platform workers that we were just talking about in case of Argentina. So I would say that it is challenging. It is a challenging work scenario globally, but there is hope and there are very positive outcomes also. At the same time, on your question of the decent work agenda, I mean, it is important, it is critical that workers all over the world have an opportunity to work in decent circumstances, decent working conditions, and are paid a fair wage. And as we know, and as our case studies show, that unfortunately is not happening. The decent work agenda is a good aspiration, and the International Labour Organization has employers, the state, and trade union representatives. So, in as much as that, it is a positive development. But the fact is that the same state and employers are the ones who are curtailing trade unions. They are the ones who are constraining the ability of labor to organize. They are fragmenting labor. They are weakening labor through industrial relations, changes in industrial relations, etc. So what I would say is it's a good agenda. It'll be great if it can be implemented. Of course, one of the mechanisms which it argues for is through regulation, through social dialogue, and importantly, through enforcement. But as the past century has shown, that regulations often exist for every arena of work, and India is a very good example. It has a law governing all aspects of work, but it's not enforced. So an important thing for the Decent Work Agenda is to regulate effectively and to enforce it. But at the same time, for the reasons that I just mentioned, it's not always done in good faith. So what I would say is that to reverse the expansion of informal and precarious work in the global south, but also the precarity in the global north and the informality which is becoming visible on the margins of formal economy in the global north, what you need is working class organization at the grassroots level, at the workplace level, through trade unions, through other labor organizations. And then what you need is solidarity and coordination across different organizations and sectors of the economy. And then to challenge the hegemony of neoliberal capitalism and the capital state alliance, which is weakening and constraining labor, to challenge that, you need to have a political organization of workers in the political arena. So what I would say is it's important, and that's what this book and the case studies have tried to show, that class conflict is central and working class solidarity and organization can actually be transformative in halting and reversing the rise of informal and precarious work.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hammer. That was Dr. Anita Hammer from King's College London. She is co-volume editor of Global Rupture, Neoliberal Capitalism and the Rise of Informal Labor in the Global South, published by Brill. You have always listened to Humanities Matter, but now you can also participate. Please tell us what you think about the Humanities Matter podcast. Are there any special topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes? Do you have thoughts about the changing world order in the 21st century you'd like us to take up? Please write to us at podcast@brill.com and let us know. We'd really love to hear from you. And if enough of you write to us about a particular topic, about the changing world order or anything else, we will explore it in a future episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Ramzi Nasser. We will see you next month.
You are listening to Humanities Matter by Brill.